Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Bloomberg.com, money markets and more on the web at www.bloomberg.com.
It's 6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. State of Minnesota is operating as usual today. Now, that in itself would normally not be a news story, but late last week, the issue was very much in doubt. The Minnesota legislature finally finished its work early Saturday morning, heading off the threat of a partial government shutdown this week. In terms of government operations, all is normal today, but much has changed as a result of the legislative session. The legislature passed a bill which makes major changes in the state property tax system. It passed education bills, which educators say dramatically underfund public education, and it passed a transportation bill that provides virtually no new money to deal with traffic and transit problems that apparently will get worse before they get better. This hour of Midday, we're going to focus on what the legislature accomplished and failed to accomplish. Minnesota Public Radio's Michael Koo, who spent many a sleepless night the past few weeks covering the legislature, has joined us from the state capitol this morning to give us a better idea of what passed and didn't pass and why. And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. We're particularly interested in getting your assessment of whether the legislature ended up finding the right balance between tax cuts and state spending, or whether you think the legislature may have gone too far one way or the other. Give us a call here. Love to have you join our conversation. 651-227-6000. That's our Twin City area number. 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Michael Koo is up the Capitol. Morning, Michael.
Good morning, Gary.
I would imagine things are fairly quiet today, are they not?
Things here at the Capitol, yes. There's very few people except for the Taste of Minnesota right outside, which lawmakers managed to escape by 7 hours or so, I think. They made it out of here just before that started. But you're right, lawmakers are not nowhere to be seen today at the Capitol, as it should be.
Is it fair to say that the tax bill was indeed the centerpiece of the legislative session?
I think that's fair to say, and it's certainly what the governor has said and what House Republicans have said, and I think even Senate Democrats, who many of whom did not support the tax bill, would nonetheless say that it is probably the single the piece of legislation that will have the longest and most important effects for the state down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that's correct.
It seemed, as we headed into the last week, that there was general agreement that the tax bill was going to pass, but yet it took all week to actually finish work. What were some of the big hang-ups last week, things that kept the legislature from quickly putting a bow on the special session and going home?
Well, there are a lot of spending issues and a lot of policy issues. The tax bill had sort of kept things wrapped up, or had kept things sort of slowed down for several weeks while people negotiated that. And as soon as they had a deal with that, then all these other issues started coming up off the back burner, and people started dealing with those. Among them were the Health and Human Services bill, which contained a number of controversial provisions, a couple of abortion provisions, a 24-hour waiting period, and a so-called gag rule that would have restricted where some state dollars could go, would have denied them to groups that offered abortion services. There was controversy over an attempt to expand children's health care coverage. And then there was the transportation bill, where, as you said at the top of the hour, didn't have a lot of new money for roads and bridges, or for transit, for that matter. And a lot of those spending issues, a lot of those policy issues that had been on the back burner, demanded some attention in that last week, and they had to do it with 1 week to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, there was something different about this session, and namely that we had the special session, went right down to the wire and so on. But other than that, was there a sense that this was somehow different, this session, different than past legislative sessions, or essentially the same, just took a little longer to get to agreement?
No, I think that anybody you talk to up here would say that this was unprecedented, that this had not happened certainly not in recent memory at any rate. And I think part of it has to do with just the complexity of that tax bill. As we said a minute ago, it was really the centerpiece of the negotiations and is a fairly sweeping overhaul of the property tax system, really complicated stuff when you get right down into the details. And, you know, it took some time to sort out those where everybody stood on those issues and to come to some compromise on those issues. And, of course, there's the our unique situation of the three-way government, which makes things perhaps a little more difficult when you have three parties at the table as opposed to only two parties. And, you know, I should point out, though, that last year we had weeks and weeks of deadlock and gridlock as well that was eventually overcome by the third decision at the very end of the session. So people point to that last year, too, in saying that it was much the same, and they had to use sort of a gimmick to get out of it. And this time there were no gimmicks. It was just a special session, overtime.
Well, stick with us, if you would, please, Michael.
Sure.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter Michael Koo up at the state capitol. Much of the fight over the tax bill that Michael referred to involved the property tax rate for businesses in the state of Minnesota. When the dust settled under the bill that finally passed, the property tax rate for businesses will be cut about 10%, and the difference between the rate that businesses and homeowners pay won't be as large as it used to be. But businesses and cabin owners will be subject to a new state property tax. Joining us now is the president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, David Olson. Good morning, Mr. Olson.
Morning, Gary.
Overall, is this a good bill from your perspective?
Yes, we do think it's a good bill. In fact, it's probably an historic bill. Any time that business can see just slightly over a 10% cut on their business property taxes is a very good day.
Business has, for the most part, I think it's fair to say, done well in Minnesota. Do you really need this tax cut?
Well, I don't know who defines whether business is doing well or not. Obviously, we like to hope that our Minnesota companies are competitive. One of the things that has hampered their expansion and their growth is the fact that we pay, at least prior to the end of this session, we paid some of the highest property taxes in the country, second or third highest, depending on where your business is located, and that has a dramatic impact on their ability to compete.
Do you expect that as a result of this tax cut, then, that we can look for further business expansion in Minnesota, more jobs and the rest?
I'm not sure we can guarantee that there will be more expansion, but it should be easier for companies to take a closer look at Minnesota. It will hopefully, for our companies that are headquartered here, this won't be that constant nuisance or the sore thumb that that they're always looking at. We hope that that good things will come out of this tax cut.
There is also the new statewide tax that businesses will be paying, and as I understand it, future increases in that tax would be devoted to education. Given the demand for more education funding, isn't it likely that business property taxes are just going to go up again in future years?
Well, hopefully not. And one of the things that we've noticed over the years is we think we do a better job of controlling our property tax increases at the state capitol, more so than we do in Worthington or Warroad or Winona or Richfield. Companies are afraid to go into their local city council and their school district and say, you know, our taxes are too high, but they've proven that they're not afraid to do that at the state capitol. So while we're concerned about the new tax, and while obviously we're not excited about a new tax, we'd like to think that we can do a reasonably good job of controlling those increases in St. Paul.
Overall, happy with the bill, then?
I think overall happy with the bill. Like I said, one of the things beyond the 10% cut is, as you mentioned in the introduction, we've compressed the rates between businesses and homeowners. And while the homeowner taxes are going down significantly more than the business property taxes, we like to think that this will now put the spotlight on what homeowners pay for local government services. It will be a lot more visible than it has been in the past, and we think then homeowners will spend more time with their school districts, spend more time with their city council, and that's a good thing.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you joining us.
No problem.
David Olson, who is president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Educators were not so happy with the way the legislative session ended. They say that schools are going to be forced to make some major cuts in staffing and programs. The tone for the debate over K-12 education spending was set way back in January when Governor Ventura proposed a lean budget that teachers and school administrators said shortchanged Minnesota students. Now, although the House and Senate more than doubled the amount of new money for schools that Ventura initially proposed, many still say the $381 million in new spending is not enough. Minnesota Public Radio's Tim Pugmire has that part of the story.
I'm aware of the governor's proposed bill, and I'm really concerned about the educational impact on our students.
Two parents in the suburban Moundsview School District produced a videotape and launched a special website this spring to help spread the word about the need for more state funding for schools. The projects couldn't prevent their school board from cutting 76 teaching positions as it tried to close a $4 million budget shortfall. Statewide, school districts sent layoff notices to about 3,000 staffers in anticipation of a lean state budget. Charles Kite, executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, says the bill's final numbers, 2.5% increases in each of the next 2 years, won't be able to reverse those decisions.
The cuts that were made were based on a funding formula that was very much like the one that was passed now. So I don't think there are going to be a lot of recalls of staff.
Kite says a few teachers will return to fill vacancies created by recent retirements, but overall he says Minnesota schools will have smaller teaching and administrative staffs this fall. That means larger class sizes and fewer programs in many schools. Scott Kroonquist of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts says school boards are also looking at ways to bring in extra money, such as higher student participation fees.
Students and parents will be paying more, you know, for everything from football and volleyball and hockey to band and choir and orchestra. All those extracurricular activities are going to require higher fees.
Few educators are applauding the funding bill, but many small rural school districts will benefit from a provision that shifts $415 per student from excess tax levies onto the general education formula. The shift is a wash for districts with such levies in place, but the 37 districts that have not been able to get local voter approval will get a financial boost. The South Kuchiching School District, for example, will see an additional $160,000 a year. The district of 387 students operates two schools located 84 miles apart in northern Minnesota. Superintendent Jerry Struess says the shift is a tremendous help.
The community's been very good about supporting education. We've had a couple of referendums for building, so we do have debt service levies in place that are pretty substantial for the size of our district. And then to go to the people again for another levy for operating expenses would be extremely difficult to sell. And so we haven't even attempted to do it.
Once they've figured out their budget, school administrators must begin adjusting to a new system for negotiating contracts with teachers and other employee groups. Governor Ventura and House Republicans pushed hard for the so-called structural balance provision, which requires district officials to show they can afford new contracts with the money they're already receiving from the state. No penalty was included. School boards like the change, but Judy Schaubach, president of the statewide teachers union Education Minnesota, says it will make negotiations difficult.
What is difficult is for school districts to try to be clairvoyant to really determine exactly what the costs will be. No one could have predicted a year ago that gas prices were going to be at the rate that they were. And, of course, what the school districts are being asked to do is project what all these different costs will be and take that into account.
After they've had a better chance to assess the bill, officials from Education Minnesota and other state organizations plan to launch a campaign to share their assessment of its full impact with state lawmakers and the public. I'm Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio.
Higher education officials have said repeatedly that the bills passed by the legislature will result in double-digit tuition increases at Minnesota universities and colleges. Polls this spring seem to show that the public had become very concerned with traffic congestion in Minnesota. They wanted improvements in both highways and transit. But the transportation bill passed by the legislature did not include much new money, and Transportation Commissioner Elwin Tinklenberg says he remains concerned about the lack of long-term funding for transportation. Joining us now to discuss that issue is Republican State Representative Carol Molnow Chaska, the chair of the House Transportation Committee. Good morning, Representative Molnow.
Good morning.
What happened with such a big budget surplus? Why was there so little new money for transportation?
Well, I think we were looking for long-term commitment for the transportation fund, and What we are looking at is a constitutional amendment where the citizens of the state, since it is their number one priority in 2002, would be able to say that they, yes, they do want additional dollars spent for roads and bridges. And we were hopeful that we could include that in this year's bill, which would have provided an added $165 million additional per year for roads and bridge construction. We also had a portion that was dedicated to transit to balance the amendment. Unfortunately, the governor and the Senate did not support that initiative, and we're going to come back next year looking again for long-term funding.
Why has this been such a contentious issue for so long? Year after year after year, various plans are proposed at the Capitol, and yet there doesn't seem to be any kind of a breakthrough on providing long-term funding for transportation. Why does that continue to occur?
I think probably because it was originally considered an either-or. Either we put it in transit or we put it in roads and bridges. The truth is it has to be both. And this bill that we passed this year gave about a 20% increase for Metro Transit, but really just the growth in the account for roads. I think many of us have looked at trying to balance that. That's why this year when we put together a constitutional amendment proposal through the conference committee process, we did come up with a 75% dedication for roads, bridges, and transit. And I was just amazed that people did not, on both sides of the aisle, including the governor's office, who's been looking for this type of long-term commitment, didn't embrace that.
Is it tough to strike a balance, particularly in a year like this past year, or this year has been, strike that balance between taking care of the individual taxpayer in terms of tax relief and the rest versus providing for, oh, the common good, transportation, highways, and the rest? Is it difficult to come up with a balance?
I don't know that it's difficult to come up with a balance necessarily. I do think it's difficult to come up with an agreement on what exactly should occur. And in the negotiating process, that became a huge issue, as you well know, 6 weeks, a little after our original sine die, we finished the legislative work, and it was basically due to a difference in philosophy. Many of us felt that this was an opportunity to do some significant property tax reform. The governor felt that. Of course, the House felt, Republican caucus felt that. And I think if we don't do those kinds of reforms in a year like this, we will never get them done. So it was an opportune time to do that. It also, however, was an opportune time to be able to allow the citizens of the state who say that transportation is one of their number one priorities to at least in 2002 be able to vote on that. Obviously, we have next session to get that amendment through, and we certainly will try.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Republican State Representative Carol Molnau, she is the chair of the House Transportation Committee. Once again, Minnesota Public Radio's Michael Koo is with us from the state capitol. And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. If you have a question about what passed and didn't pass, if you have some thoughts on whether the legislature struck the right balance between tax cuts and state spending, give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Michael, was there much talk during the legislative session, particularly toward the end, about trying to find a balance so that everybody could be happy, or were legislators so focused on the specifics of legislation that broader philosophical debate never really got too far?
Are you talking about in transportation or just in general?
In general.
Well, I mean, I think they were constantly striving to find some sort of middle ground, and as you'll recall, on June 22nd, the governor brought the two sides together with a deal that he said essentially split the middle on a lot of the important issues. And I think that's right, that the deal sort of did split the middle, although there are some issues where it's hard to find a middle ground, and particularly, as we were talking about earlier, some of those social issues like abortion, very hard to find a middle ground on something like that. And and there were some, you know, fairly strong philosophical feelings tied up with some of these bills that helped prolong this session.
Joe, your assessment, did the legislature find a good balance in your mind?
You talking to me on the phone?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay. As a matter of fact, I think they really did try to do that. The comment that I was making was more on the business side. We kept on hammering that, you know, why are the businesses getting more of a tax break and whatnot. And I had a conversation with someone who knows intimately a higher level 3M executive, and 3M had said for years that they'll always try to put Minnesota first and think of Minnesota as far as any expansion. But he said that in the back room, when they would always do the analysis, because of the tax structure here, Minnesota never came out on top, and that's why they've opened up, you know, such facilities down in Austin and whatnot, Texas, that is, not Minnesota. And I think it does have an impact, and that you have to look at businesses because they are the ones who do indeed provide the jobs. And you can't just say, hey, we're going to put the burden on the businesses when we're already one of the highest tax states in the nation for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think that they did really try to do a better balance on this particular legislative session, and I hope it continues so that we can have more jobs and get some of the more income that's associated with that for the taxes to spread it around a little bit more.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate the comment.
Thank you.
Let's move on to another caller here. Mark Ash is on the line. He's the president of Common Cause. Morning, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. Your assessment, did the legislature come up with approximately the right balance, you think?
I think what we're seeing is the end result of the repeal of the ban on soft money that led to these excesses of spending, $900,000 of soft money in our last state legislative election. Each caucus in House and Senate became bound by their paymasters. And the people wound up with a six-week delay in reaching an outcome that should have been done during the regular session. But the teachers on the Democratic side, the business community on the left, both of whom poured in hundreds of thousands of dollars to enable the caucuses as opposed to candidates, we're talking about parties here, to enable these parties to make soft money expenditures, really has warped the process. We had one election in which $200,000 of party money was spent in an election that was supposed to have a cap of $40,000 under our campaign finance law. And I think the people lost and the governor lost for the people by refusing to make campaign finance reform a serious issue. Here we have McCain-Feingold passing at the national level, and Minnesota just sits on its hands.
Legislators would say that they're not bought and sold. They would argue that they are representing deeply held philosophical positions, and they're not doing anybody's bidding.
I'm a former legislator, and that's a bunch of garbage. I know how people act. They know who gave them money, the caucuses particularly. Bills get on the floor and are held off the floor, in large part depending on contributions. It's not a secret. Everyone knows it. And they have refused to plug the hole. They had to put five words in the statute to ban soft money expenditures by the parties, and they simply have refused. And the governor has conspired with them to let it happen.
Do you think the governor said when he proposed his final plan there, he said he was giving up on campaign finance reform in the effort to end the session on time and avoid a shutdown. Do you think he should have stuck to his guns and forced a government shutdown over this issue?
The governor was willing to stick to his guns and force a shutdown over the application of conflict of interest regulate statutes to the governor. That he was willing to do on Saturday. He was willing to stop Senator Cohen and Representative Pinky from applying conflict of interest statutes to him. But he couldn't, on behalf of the people, advance campaign finance reform. I mean, that's ludicrous. The governor was in a position early in the session of having 42 civic groups led by the League of Women Voters and the Common Cause pushing for campaign finance reform. They didn't work with those civic groups. They turned their back on them, met behind closed doors with the legislative leaders, and came out with nothing. And we're supposed to believe that he was there fighting when he won't even take people in to fight with him?
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Mark Ash, who is the president of Common Cause, with his assessment of the legislative session. Interested in your thoughts on whether or not there was an appropriate balance, when all was said and done, whether there was an appropriate balance struck by legislators, primarily over the issue of tax cuts and state spending. Michael Koo is with us from the state capitol. Michael covered the entire session and spent many a sleepless night the last week, 10 days or so, as legislators tried to finish their work. By the way, before we break for news here, Michael, was there much public input at the Capitol as the days were ticking along and the government shutdown looming? Were legislators getting bombarded with public comment, or did the public largely seem indifferent to what was going on?
My sense is, Gary, that the public felt or was largely indifferent, as you put it. I talked to a couple of lawmakers who said that, you know, they got a couple of phone calls, a couple of emails, a few enough that they could respond to each one personally, and that most Minnesotans seemed to be out enjoying the summer. We finally had some decent weather. They went out to the cabin. They went out golfing. They went out fishing or whatever, and were largely oblivious to the deadlock over here at the Capitol. I think if it had gone to shutdown, people would have started paying attention, but they narrowly avoided that scenario.
651-227-6000. If you'd like to join our conversation, love to hear from you. 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. The state government is operating as normal today, but it truly was touch and go. All the work was finally finished early Saturday morning. But today, as the dust starts to settle, we're interested in your assessment of how the legislature performed its job, whether they found about the right balance in terms of tax cuts, state spending, and the rest. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Get to more of your comments here in a couple of minutes.
On the next Fresh Air, Walter Kern talks about his new novel, Up in the Air, a satirical look at the frustrations and discomforts of life in airports and airplanes. The main character is a business traveler whose goal is to earn 1 million frequent flyer miles. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's at 8 o'clock tonight here on Minnesota Public Radio. Of course, Minnesota Public Radio is made possible by the generous financial support of listeners like you, so many of you responded last week. We thank you heartily. News headlines now. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary, and good morning. United Airlines and U.S. Airways are confirming that the two companies are talking about possibly abandoning their proposed merger sometime before August 1st. They say they'll make no further comment on the matter for now. If United ends the agreement, it will have to pay U.S. Airways a breakup fee of $50 million. Published reports say United wants out of its planned $4.3 billion purchase of U.S. Airways because of regulatory problems and the worsening economy. Union officials are sounding optimistic that they can avert an entertainment industry walkout. Hollywood actors and producers are to resume contract talks today following a marathon bargaining session that lasted into the early morning hours. Union officials say there has been progress. President Bush says he's not worried about Vice President Cheney's health. Bush told reporters after meeting with Cheney this morning that the vice president looks great and his spirits are high. Cheney returned to work today, just 2 days after doctors implanted a pacemaker in his chest. Cheney's spokeswoman says he's keeping a typical schedule today, but he has no public appearances planned. In regional news, some of the teenagers and adults on a Minnesota charter bus that overturned on a Colorado mountain pass are defending the driver. The group of high school students from Burnsville was headed to a camp run by a Christian youth group when the accident happened Saturday near the summit of Kenosha Pass. The bus went off the road and rolled over its side. The bus driver from Minnesota City was arrested after his release from the hospital on 45 counts of careless driving and causing injury. He's being held on a $45,000 bond. The forecast for Minnesota calls for scattered showers and thunderstorms spreading from west to east today. High temperatures ranging from 68 in the northeast to near 78 in the far west. Right now in Duluth, a report of light rain in 57. It's cloudy in Brainerd in 54. Partly sunny in Rochester and 60 degrees. And in the Twin Cities, some scattered clouds and a temperature of 60 degrees. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. 25 minutes before 12. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. And this hour, we're interested in your assessment of the work that the legislature did this year. The legislative special session finally came to a close early Saturday morning. We're interested today in finding out whether you believe that when all was said and done, things turned out as you hoped they would, or whether or not there were some glaring omissions, and for that matter, sins of commission as well. Michael Ku is with us from the state capitol. Might review, Michael, one issue that got lots and lots of attention during the session were the abortion-related provisions. Did any of those end up in law?
No, although they were in the House's negotiating position right up until the last week. As you know, the governor was adamantly opposed to that and had said on numerous occasions that he would veto any legislation that contained those provisions. The Senate, although it has a slight pro-life majority in it, a lot of the leadership, though, are supporters of abortion rights. So the Senate had during the negotiations, was more with the governor on that. But in the end, all that came out totally taken out of the language.
Now, my understanding, though, was as part of that final settlement, they also dropped the governor's plan for money for teen pregnancy prevention programs. Is that right? That's
right. The governor had requested about $20 million for teen pregnancy prevention grants, and it also asked for a boost in the state's family planning grants. And the Republicans in the House had said that if you wanted that money for the new program as well as for the boost in the existing program, they wanted to tie that to a provision that would deny the state money from going to any group that offers abortion services or even abortion counseling. And as a result, when the final deal was cut, the so-called gag rule was left on the table, and the new money was also left on the table, or I should say taken off the table, gotten rid of.
Mm-hmm. Callers on the line from Minneapolis. Gary, go ahead. Your assessment, please.
Good morning. I have just a general comment on the legislative session. I'm really ashamed of the way the legislature performed. And even though I like my current state senator and state representative, if I get a credible candidate running against them this year, especially in a party battle, I'm going to vote for the challenger.
Now, you're upset because they took so long or because of what they actually ended up approving?
The way they ran the legislative session is an abomination, stalling till the last minute. I can't begin to tell you how disappointed I am with their performance, and I really feel strongly that they can't be allowed to get away with this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I say, a credible candidate running, I vote for him. I'll take my response off the air.
Just before you run there, Gary, I'm just wondering now, are you, setting aside your unhappiness with mm-hmm. with the process,
mm-hmm.
are you generally pleased with the result?
No, they didn't attend to the issue that Carol Molyneux pointed out, the committee that she chairs. They didn't deal with transportation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they spent time on all these really absurd issues in the first part of the session. They should have gotten into the primary things, the property tax reform and so forth, very important. But it's not an excuse. It's not something to put off till next year for some political reason or whatever their whatever the agenda was behind the scenes, whether they wanted to go to the last minute and send Ventura something that he didn't have time to even kick back to him for a rebuttal, if they just wanted to stall out for the last moment to sandbag him. I don't care.
Okay.
It's not acceptable performance.
Okay. Thanks for your comment, Gary. Appreciate it. Michael, did you get any sense as to why it was that the transportation issue was so difficult to resolve at the end? It seemed like that one was pretty well cut and dried, and then it got bogged down and took quite a long while to resolve.
Yeah, you're right about that. When the special session first came back, transportation was one of the working groups that they felt would wrap up one of the quickest. And I think that it started off because, as Representative Molnow stated in her remarks, the House was asking for a constitutional dedication of the MVET, or the Motor Vehicle Excise Tax, to roads and bridges, and some money, of course, would also go to transit. The Senate had originally had a similar provision in their bill, and the two sides were just trying to, find some way to make the two bills meet up. But in the June 22nd agreement that Ventura and his administration brokered, they asked that there be no such dedication. I believe the concern was that if you dedicate that money to roads and bridges and if the economy doesn't perform too well, then you've got that all those funds locked up and they can't be used for other needs that the state has. And so they wanted that provision to be at least delayed a year and not voted on in this session. So when that came out, it really sort of threw a monkey wrench in the process, and Republicans felt that they, you know, if they were going to lose that dedication, they wanted to go back and revisit a lot of the other parts of the transportation bill, and that really tied things up for quite a while.
Nancy, your comment, please.
Yes, I would just like to say that I'm concerned and saddened by what seems to be a selfish direction our state and country are going. An example is the tax refund and property tax reform, which benefits each of us, to me, seems very little. We have this huge surplus, and yet we're scrambling to pay for early care and education, health care for children and the elderly, housing, and education K through college.
Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose people who support the property tax bill would argue that long-term this is terrific for Minnesotans, not just in the short run in terms of getting a check, but in terms of simplifying and improving a fundamental tax system. And to get to that, you know, it costs some money, which came out of the surplus. I gather you don't buy that.
I don't. I feel like we're more concerned with ourselves and less with the common good of people. And there's so many people that are homeless and so many children in poor quality child care. And I just feel we have an obligation to help others.
Mm-hmm. Last question for you, Nancy. It was pointed out, especially early in the legislative session, that the requests for increased state spending on, for the most part, presumably legitimate programs, legitimate state needs, far exceeded the surplus that was available and would actually have required a tax increase. Do you think that the needs are such that the legislature should have talked about increasing taxes rather than cutting taxes?
I'm not sure about an increase, but definitely not a decrease in taxes.
Okay. Thanks, Nancy.
You're welcome. Bye.
Michael, did you hear any kind of debate like that at all at the Capitol? Was there were any legislators talking like Nancy?
Well, you certainly heard some very similar thoughts from Senate Democrats and even some House Democrats who felt that the state was maybe going overboard with the tax cuts and not putting enough money into K-12 education, higher education, and as we've already talked about, transportation. But, you know, going back to January when the governor first outlined his budget proposal, this idea of a lean budget and major emphasis on tax cuts really started way back then, and it's sort of been the theme that the governor has kept up all session long into the special session. House Republicans joined him almost immediately on those fronts, and it's been sort of, like I said, a theme of high or large cuts in taxes and very minimal single-digit growth in spending, and that's what we ended up with.
Elaine, your comment, please.
Yes, well, I heard your speaker earlier say that he thought that the public was largely, or maybe you, Gary, said the public was largely indifferent to what was going on, and I hear this over and over again when I listen to talk shows while I'm driving or I listen to lobbyists speak up, and I just want to say that I really believe that the public cares strongly about these things, but the public also have lives to lead, and we are inundated with issues to deal with and things to care about and children to raise and jobs to go to, that just because those legislators don't hear from us doesn't mean we don't care. And I think they should give the public more credit for being intelligent and not thinking that they are the only ones dealing with these things and no one's paying attention.
Mm-hmm. If your legislator called you up, Elaine, and said, gee, I really would like to reflect your views. I know you're a busy person. Is there any way they can get a good handle on where you stand and where your neighbors stand on issues, short of you contacting them?
Well, you know, I don't know what they try to do. I haven't ever heard from my legislator except for you know, what I do see coming across sometimes are surveys. Maybe it's a survey from the Republican Party, which I think is wanting to only find out if I'm interested in freedom for gun owners. You know, everything, so much of the information is run by people who are into marketing and public relations that often the information is going to be twisted. And we've heard more and more about that, that even the federal government uses public relations people all the time now for information. So all of our information is twisted. If someone called me up, or if I had a way that was simple to communicate, but I can't always get on my computer to send email, I don't always have the phone numbers available.
Right.
I go to the school when my Wayzata Public School District is cutting $750 million out of the high school budget this year, and you better believe I was at the meeting, and they had expensive consultants running the meeting, and they didn't really want to hear what I had to say. And you have parents, you know, wanting to cut special ed. You know, we want to save those babies when they're in the NICU. I'm a nurse. I just worked at one of the hospitals. It was on strike. And so I'm affected by these things, and yet, you know, we want to save the babies, but when they're 5 or 8 or 15 and they need special ed, we don't want to pay anymore because it's taking money from our smart kids.
Right.
So we're very inconsistent as a public, but I think the legislators, I think they're in their own little bubble, and they kind of think that they're the only ones that are thinking about these things. People do care, and they're trying to live their lives, and if they had an easier way to communicate with their legislators, I think they'd have strong opinions.
Thanks, Elaine.
Thanks a lot.
What's your sense, Michael? Do legislators feel like they have a good their finger on the pulse of their constituents, or oftentimes do they feel like they're operating in the dark?
No, I think they certainly feel like they represent their particular districts and the constituents that voted them into office. And, you know, I didn't mean to say earlier that people don't care, although it is true, I think, that people weren't, you know, marching up to the Capitol with pitchforks and torches the way that, say, for example, with the twins debate of a couple years ago when, you know, the place was flooded with phone calls that literally shut down the Capitol switchboard.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen this year. You know, there were far fewer people registering their opinions than you might have expected. And part of it is, of course, that people do have busy lives to lead, and they don't always the Capitol isn't the first thing in their minds all the time. But to your original question, I think that the lawmakers try to stay pretty connected to their communities and to the districts that elected them. I think they sort of have to as a matter of political survival.
Greg is on the line from Bemidji with a comment. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah. I guess I would have to say that I think the fault with the legislature, I think they really did a good job of representing their different views, and that there was a lot of heavy things with the property tax change that they were dealing with that caused them to go longer. I think the indictment is on the public not being involved. And in the special session, even though I was contacting my legislature people, I didn't have the sense that a lot of other people were doing it, and I think, especially with the 4th of July, you know, the old adage, democracy, it's not what you have, it's what you do, really applies, and I think as Minnesota society, we are losing touch with our government because we're choosing to entertain ourselves rather than to really get involved about the issues that define our state.
Mm-hmm. Elaine says, though, that people are simply too busy to be spending a whole lot of time trying to look up the number of their legislator and figure out how to contact them, and so they got a life to lead.
Well, Elaine, let me tell you, you write down the number for your legislators by the phone so you have it handy when you think about it and can give them a call. You've got to, if you do have a computer or access to the internet, you just put that on your address and you can zip them off a message right away. And I know I had my legislators actually personally contact me during the special session because they weren't getting contacted by other people. They had free enough time to contact me personally.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, I think people are choosing to entertain themselves take their mind off of what we really need to focus on. And we need to get back to some citizen values, and we need to talk about what democracy is.
All right.
We don't get stuck with it. It's what we do or don't do.
Thanks, Greg. Let's move on to John, who joins us now from Minneapolis. Your comment, John?
I'm calling because I'm just utterly disappointed in the results of this legislative session. I feel that the legislature really rolled over early on. The governor presented a draconian kind of budget, and I think that the legislators, instead of showing some real leadership, they perceived the governor's position as being largely popular, and they went along with a rebate when we have huge needs in education, in health care, in a lot of areas in this state, and they didn't provide any real leadership and stand up to the governor and say, no, this isn't what the people of Minnesota need. So I'm just very disappointed in the way they conduct themselves and in the results that they came up with.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people would argue, John, that what the people really needed was cutting taxes, and they needed their money back.
Well, I think that it's hard to argue that $280 per person is going to really provide a great deal of assistance to anybody. I think in reality, I'm most disappointed in the Democrats, who I look to really provide leadership in the areas of education and social services. In the end, I felt they just tried to make themselves look good, whereas early on, they could have really taken a stand. They could have taken it to the people. They could have said, do you want to see teachers cut? Do you want to see class sizes go up? Instead, they're happy to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on the profile of learning while our class sizes go up and while teachers and school districts are not even able to fund heating and lighting and have paper and supplies.
All right. Thanks, John. Appreciate the comment. Michael Koo, before we go here, before we wrap up, I wanted to get a comment from you. What in the final analysis were legislators saying about the governor's performance during the legislative session? On occasion, they were very critical, but then we were talking with the legislative leaders, Mo and Swigum, a couple weeks ago on the air, and they basically said, oh, he's done fine. Well, yeah. Well, what was the final analysis?
The final analysis was polite. I think that Senator Moe and Speaker Swigum, as well as some of the other lead negotiators, would say that most of the administration's involvement was through the governor's commissioners, particularly Finance Commissioner Pam Wheelock and Revenue Commissioner Matt Smith. The governor wasn't involved in day-to-day detailed negotiations, but he sort of worked through proxy with some of his top aides. Maybe not as deeply involved as some previous governors have been, but you know, they say that if you have good people working for you, maybe that's okay, and they've been pretty polite about the governor's performance, I think.
Michael, thanks for joining us, and great job.
Thanks you. Thank you.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter Michael Koo joining us from the state capitol. Of course, we'd also like to thank all of you who've been with us this hour, especially those of you who called in or tried to call in with your questions and comments. Much, much more on the on what the legislature did and did not do coming up on All Things Considered this afternoon, including a special report at 5:30 this afternoon.
Here in Silicon Valley, there tends to be an attitude that we're the center of the universe, which is not true.
The World's Rebecca Roberts reports on the latest technology and its effects on people's lives worldwide.
Whether it's wiring schools in Nigeria or genetically modified food protests in Germany, there are different attitudes about technology in the world.
I'm Lisa Mullins. Keep up with the day's news from a global perspective on the world.
7 o'clock here on Minnesota Public Radio. Right now it's 5 minutes before 12.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 2nd of July, 2001. It's the birthday of the novelist Elizabeth Graver, born in Los Angeles in 1964. Her first book was a collection of short stories, Have You Seen Me? A title story about a girl who makes up stories about the missing children pictured on milk cartons. Her first novel, Unraveling, set in the mills of 19th century Lowell, Massachusetts. It was on this day in 1961, Ernest Hemingway took his own life with a shotgun at his home in Ketchum, Idaho. A year before he'd been forced to leave his home in Cuba, he'd become paranoid, depressed, was suffering from writer's block. He'd gone twice to the Mayo Clinic for electroshock therapy. About 10 years before, in The Old Man and the Sea, he wrote, "A man can be destroyed, but not defeated." It was on this day in 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan took off from New Guinea, headed for Howland Island on their trip around the world. It was the last time anybody saw them. They disappeared over the Pacific Ocean. They were never seen again. It's the birthday of the author of many books for children and young adults, Jean Craighead George, born in Washington, 1919, best known for her book My Side of the Mountain and Julie of the Wolves, both based on her childhood. Her parents were naturalists. She grew up spending a lot of time outdoors. It's the birthday of the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, born in Baltimore, 1908. He was named Thurgood after a grandfather, and in grade school changed his name because he was tired of spelling it. It's the birthday of the theater director Sir Tyrone Guthrie, born in Tunbridge Wells, England, 1900. He was an announcer for the BBC, then started to write plays for radio, became a major director at the Old Vic and Sadler's Wells theaters in London during the 30s, directed operas in the 40s, Carmen and Peter Grimes at the Met, established the Shakespeare Festival in Stratford, Ontario in 1953, and 10 years later opened the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. It's the birthday of the photographer André Kertész, born in Budapest in 1894. He got a Leica camera, a small handheld camera, in 1928, one of the first of them, and used it to capture the life on the streets of Paris during the 1930s. Later took many photographs from the balcony of his apartment overlooking Washington Square Park in New York. And it's the birthday of the novelist Hermann Hesse, born in 1877 in Germany. He was a pacifist. He suffered a mental breakdown during World War I, underwent psychoanalysis, an experience which found its way into his novel Demian. He was also fascinated with Eastern philosophy, wrote Siddhartha, based on the early life of Buddha. His other novels included Steppenwolf and Narcissus and Goldmund. Here's a poem for today by Charles Bukowski, the old pinch hitter. Comes out of the dugout in the last of the ninth, two out, the winning run up. For 20 in this young season, 350, he walks slowly to the plate, seems relaxed but deliberate. Faces a fireballing young pitcher, 18 years younger than he is. Takes ball one, ball two. Fouls off the next two, then runs it to 3-2. The fireballer gets his sign, checks second, blazes it in as the runner goes, the perfect pitch, the perfect strike, knee-high and inside, click! Nobody can handle it, a solid liner between first and second. The runner from second scores. The old pinch hitter touches first, then turns and walks slowly toward the dugout. Another night's work. That shower is going to feel good. A poem by Charles Bukowski, the old pinch hitter, from Open All Night, published by Black Sparrow Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find millions of gently read classics, bestsellers, rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.